Is this on?
Yes, my lord.
Good. Hello, this is God speaking. Can we dial that down?
Yes, my lord.
Thanks. Welcome, new arrival to the Eternity Ward. Please take a number and make your way down to the left or the right to the waiting room. All you need is the refreshments I made just for you. I would tell you to steer clear of the apples, they're forbidden, and the two snakes. I mean, fools, sorry, that are chewing the fat in the corner, but you probably wouldn't listen anyway. So good luck, I bless you, and on your way.
Welcome to the Eternity Ward, where we flick through old copies of Reader's Digest and chat with our buddies while we wait for an appointment with God. I'm Nick McKinnon.
And I'm Chris Adams. Yes, and welcome. The Eternity Ward. Why are we calling it the Eternity Ward, Nick?
It was your idea.
Yeah. Well, this is obviously going to be sort of a spiritual, religious, God-type-themed podcast, which is, well, I guess, what are our credentials for talking about God? I mean, I grew up in a Christian family, Christian community even when I was a child, and my parents were missionaries, although their mission field was Australia. So we travelled around a fair bit, saw a fair bit of Australia. And but then I left Christianity around 14, 15 years of age and returned probably about 14, 15 years later. And been calling myself a Christian since, been a chaplain for about 8 years. I think you've got a couple of years on me, Nick. So that's sort of a bit of who I am. Is that credentials enough? What are your credentials?
Good question. Not dissimilar to you. I grew up in a Christian household. My dad is a pastor and has been for as long as I've been alive. So I grew up in church communities. Was part of youth groups, ran youth groups, that sort of thing, ran Christian religious programs at the local schools. Like you, have been a chaplain for quite a while. That's how we first came in contact, I think, and have been doing that ever since. And, you know, so got to know you, got to know a bunch of other chaplains who sort of shared the same sort of heretical views on things a lot of the times. I've always been someone that enjoys questions and likes feeling free to express whatever doubts I have. For those people that do know any bits about the Bible, my favorite book of the Bible was always Job, where Job had everything taken from him and he got pissed off with God, and that was okay. It's okay to be pissed off with God was sort of the message I got from that. And so I've done my Job best and been pissed off with God ever since.
Yeah, and you've spoken to me about Job a lot, and we've had lots of conversations over the years. We're best buddies, right?
Absolutely.
Best buddy, Nick. But you wanted to do a podcast. You asked me to do this podcast. Why was that?
So we were both chaplains in Tasmania for quite a while, and then you and your lovely wife ditched the better part of Australia and left for the big smoke in Sydney. And that sort of left me with no friends and no one to have these sort of conversations with. And so it sort of crossed my mind that both you and I have been writing blogs for quite a while. And certainly for myself, I've found that a really useful way to straighten my curly thoughts out and get them out of my head. And I thought that having these sort of conversations with you would both get those thoughts out and as well enable me to have those sort of deep, interesting conversations with you that we had for all those years. And also I always appreciate, especially hearing from people who I disagree with. And you and I, we don't disagree on everything, but there are things we disagree with. And I always find it really useful to talk with people that you're able to discuss the issue and not get caught up in personality sort of stuff. So regardless of how much we disagree with each other, we always come at the conversations with respect for the other person, and that sort of enables both of us to share whatever it is that is going on, whatever crazy thoughts we have. We're not worried that we're going to be stoned to death, as would have happened in many religious communities throughout the ages.
I still refer to you as a heathen.
Well, that's good by me.
But that is one of the major differences, I guess, between us lately in our journeys as a friendship, is that you've had this problem, you've been on this journey recently where, am I right to say, you're not calling yourself a Christian anymore?
Yeah, well, so I've certainly, I think I've come across a lot of questions that have led me to have significant doubts about many of the things that I grew up believing. There's a lot of these sort of things that have come up. So, like, the simple, or not simple, but the common ones of like evil and suffering in the world. How does evolution fit with belief in God? What's the deal with hell? Did God really have to send his son to be tortured and killed so that God could forgive us humans because he created them faulty? Why are there so many religions and gods? Why is the Bible so horrific? All of those sort of things just sort of picked at the seams of my faith and left me wondering, well, if I've got all of these doubts and there are these other Christians out there who have views that are so the opposite of what I hold, in what sense am I a Christian? If they're a Christian, then I can't really be.
So just a few problems. So we've got, what, half an hour, 45 minutes? You want me to get through all of them for you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got one to get you started.
We can sort it out tonight, you know.
Brilliant. Well, it's like one of the things that has fascinated me for a long time, and it's one of the things that the more removed from Christianity I got, the more pissed off I got at Christians, is the where is God? Like, where is he? It's so weird to me that, like, I could spend 20 years sitting at the edge of my bed praying to this invisible being and not hearing anything back for all of that time. And the thing that annoys me so much is that, like, when I was growing up as a kid, people would use words like that they hear from God. They use words like hear, or that God speaks to them. And the more I grew in age, I suppose, and spent more time with people who said those things, the more I realized that they weren't meaning those words in any way that is what the words actually mean in the English language. There's almost no one that claims to actually hear audible words from God. And so I got really pissed off that I got sent this message that, no, that's the aim, that you actually want to hear audibly from God. And so then to find out 20 years later that no one actually does was infuriating to me. Like, I don't know why you would use a word to mean something that you don't actually mean, when it leads to so much confusion and feelings of inadequacy, the feeling that everyone else is having this awesome relationship with God when he just doesn't talk to me. And so now realizing that, no, God doesn't talk to anyone. is a baffling idea, if God really does exist, that he would create us, sit idly by watching, you know, 2 billion Christians sitting at the ends of their bed praying and not answering 99.8% of them. So I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on where is God, why isn't there, like, real evidence that he exists? If he really created this whole thing, why would he conceal his craftsmanship? Go.
Oh, well, I need to sort of establish first up that I too have problems, and I too have many doubts. I don't think I have answers for you, Nick, but so you say you're not a Christian, but, you know what, do you still have some sort of belief in a sense? Do you have a belief?
I don't think so. I think I've moved so far that I don't see the value in belief. So I remember hearing Tim Minchin interviewed one time, and he got asked something along the lines of, you don't just believe things you have evidence for, do you? And he sort of looked at the interviewer bewilderedly and going, well, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And that was quite a strange moment for me, because I was on the other side of the fence at that time. Like, I liked him as a comedian and found him to be hilarious, and subversive, which is something I've always liked.
Yeah.
And so to hear him just flat out say, yeah, I only believe things that I have evidence for, was a shocking admission for me. To hear someone that I already knew was intelligent just say that flat out just made me go, oh, maybe that is a decent way to be. And so that got me thinking. It made me start thinking, well, why would you believe something that you have no evidence for?
So if you don't believe, then why do we have these forever conversations about God?
Yeah, good question. I think much like Mulder from The X-Files, I want to believe. I don't know whether it's just because of the upbringing I've had. I don't, like, maybe if I was brought up in Richard Dawkins' family, maybe I wouldn't feel the same way. But I know there is something in me that wants there to be a God. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I like that answer. I guess conversely, I'm sort of someone who, because of all of the doubts that I have, I sometimes feel like it would be easier if I didn't believe. I would sort of like to not believe, but I find that hard. I feel like there's something sort of in my bones that says that I believe, so hence I do call myself a Christian still.
So there was an author that you put me onto, Chris, a guy called Peter Rowlands.
Yeah.
Who wrote a book called Insurrection, which was part of my journey out of faith, or out of calling myself a Christian anyway.
Oops, my fault.
Yeah, that's right. So he's a really interesting guy. Like, he calls himself a theologian, and I don't know whether he's a Christian or not. He doesn't seem to be to me. But so he wrote this book called Insurrection, and he articulated this idea that to believe in a supernatural being that is totally powerful, can do anything, is in charge of everything, and loves me as an individual unconditionally, that's a powerful drug to take hold of. And so Peter Rowlands says that this sort of belief in that being that loves me is a very human belief, because all of us want to be loved. All of us want to feel like there is something out there that loves us. And so he talks about that when we were tiny little kids, we sought that love from our parents. And as we got older, we realized that our parents had interests outside of ourselves. So from there, we looked to friendship groups or to romantic partners, and we tried to find someone that would just love us completely and that we would be their whole world. And the older we get, the more we realize that there's no one out there that just thinks that I am their everything. The idea that we can then put all of that on God and say, well, there's no people that actually love me completely and are obsessed with me and only want to think about me for their whole lives, but at least I can just pretend there's a God up there that loves me unconditionally and will never, ever stop loving me no matter how awful I am. Reading that from his book made a lot of sense to me, that there's a lot of just basic psychological, I don't know if that's a word.
Psychological is a word.
Excellent. Thank you, Dictionary Chris. That there's a lot of very psychological explanations for these things, and that there isn't necessarily a Wizard of Oz behind the curtains.
One of the things that he said, I remember, was God is not approached as an object that we must love, but as a mystery present in the very act of love itself. I also like the fact that it's got the word mystery in there, because I know how much you like the word mystery.
Oh, we're going to get there.
You don't look, no, okay. I'm not a fan of the word mystery either.
Yeah, we will get there. But I am a fan of the word mystery. I'm just not a fan of it being used to cover up nothing.
Fair enough, yeah. I'm not a fan of it either. But sometimes it's hard to find the words or the ideas, the opinions, the belief, the faith, the way to describe something which is indescribable.
But why would it necessarily be indescribable? If I create a painting, it doesn't then make me indescribable just because I created something. Like, there's no reason why God should be indescribable. If he wanted to make himself obvious to all of us, presumably that should be really easy for him to do if he's all powerful.
Yeah, sure.
But he doesn't.
Yeah, so maybe he doesn't want to.
Yeah, okay. So then we have to say, well, why would he not want to? Why would he want to keep us in the dark as to whether he exists?
I mean, how would the world be different if we knew that he existed? If we knew for sure and he was present and, you know, he sat on a throne somewhere and did media press releases and interviews and appeared in, you know, video clips for famous musicians, I don't know. How would the world be different if we knew that God was present and existed?
Okay, well, for starters, if we assume that he is all-loving, that would get rid of a lot of evil in the world. There would be no ISIS if God was obviously present and obviously good. There would be no Westboro Baptist Church if God was obviously here on earth and obviously good. So to me, there are obvious benefits in an all-loving God making himself really impossible to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, I would give you the reverse question. What are the benefits in hiding yourself? Other than creating confusion for these tiny little ants that you just created.
Well, I think it sort of comes down to these tiny little ants that have been created in the image of God, in the sense that we, you know, that God is a creator, we can be creative, that God can be loving. I think all the best attributes of humanity, you know, sort of tell us, describe, I guess, a bit about who God is, what God is. But I think if God was present, then it takes away some aspect of free will for me. The free will to choose whether to believe or not is one choice. If God's present, we can't choose to believe that God exists or not. I don't think God needs us to believe that God exists. Do you get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I've just got like a bunch of different thoughts and...
Throw one at me.
Yeah, but I don't know if they're going to sort of skip into areas that we wanted to go to later. So like the idea of that taking away all doubt about whether God exists, if that's a bad thing, well then what's heaven? Like, because presumably if there is a heaven and we get there, then there won't be any doubt that God exists. If heaven is a good place, then why not just have all those things now?
I mean, I sort of believe that if we're created as free will beings, then, you know, post our death in going to some sort of heaven, that we would still be free will beings. So that's an interesting question you pose me, which puts me in a bit of a bind. But I think the concept for me that we're focusing on heaven as being this after thing is one of the issues. One of the problems for me is I don't think we should be focusing on having our eyes to the sky and missing all that's happening right in front of us. So like Jesus always talked about the kingdom, and he always, the concept of that was bringing the kingdom, you know, bringing heaven to earth. So the focus being on what's going to come after is wrong as far as I'm concerned. It's misleading. If you're focusing on heaven, you should be bringing that to here, bringing that to the now.
Yeah, so the people that I see in our world that are most focused on an afterlife are groups like ISIS.
What about, you know, the fundamentalist Christians who, you know, are quite happy for Armageddon to come along? They're trying to speed it up because then they get to spend eternity with Jesus, you know. They want to bring about the end of the world because the world doesn't matter. They just want their ticket.
Yeah, I learnt this word that makes me feel intelligent when I use it, this word pernicious. So pernicious is a idea that seems like a good thing but is actually has quite negative consequences. And so for a long time, I thought this idea of heaven is just like there's no negative side to it, that it's just a lovely, beautiful idea that after all is said and done, there will be this final judgment for everyone and everyone will get to live in this awesome place. But the negative side of it is that, yeah, it completely devalues life here. And so groups like ISIS, who actually believe that there is a existence after this one where God is in charge and there is no suffering, with that sort of belief, there's nothing wrong with walking into a preschool full of kindergarten kids and blowing them up, because as soon as they die, they're going to be straight there in heaven with God straight away. So yeah, this idea of heaven is it's one of these beliefs that I had for a long time, thinking it was a really positive thing, and then went, oh, this is actually, in the real world, this is quite a scary belief. And so that idea that you talked about, that heaven isn't really a physical reality in some sort of afterlife, but it's actually meant to describe just the here and now and the us bringing, you know, is sort of the Lord's Prayer talks about bringing the kingdom of heaven to earth as opposed to us evacuating to heaven afterwards. That sort of idea is a nice one, but it's just nowhere near the dominant theory of heaven that is prevalent in any religion that I've come across.
Any religion surely has the words "thou shalt not kill" right as the top commandment, right? Have they missed that one?
So the problem is that there's different verses in any text, the Bible I know better than others, but there's verses that are incongruous. So there's verses that say "thou shalt not kill," but there's also verses that say if your son swears at you, put him to death. So it seems like the idea is, I don't know what you do with that. So to me, I just sort of come at it and go, well, it's just a book written by people 2,000 years ago, and obviously there's going to be contradictions in there because they're humans and humans have lots of contradictions. I have lots of contradictions. Yeah. I'm sure you do.
Yeah, and one of them you were just sort of pointing out before, that believing heaven is something that we should be doing and bringing now, but I also do believe in a, you know, some eternal thing. Hence we've got our eternity ward that we're talking about. We're sort of sitting here in this ward waiting.
Yeah, and so like I talked about this near the start, I think I talked about I want there to be a God. As part and parcel of that for me is I want there to be an afterlife. I don't want to end.
Yeah.
It's a scary thought to have had existence and then to feel like it could be taken away from you. And all of us have people that we've loved and are no longer with us. And I've certainly had those. I know you've had those too. And I don't want that to be it. I want there to be something afterwards where I can get to know the people that I didn't have enough time to get to know. But, you know, just because you want something doesn't mean it's real. It's one of the uglinesses of adulthood. You grow up and realize that many of the things that you wanted to be true aren't. There's no tooth fairy, there's no Santa. Like we talked about before, your parents have interests outside of you. Once you grow up and leave the house, they get divorced, and they were only ever together just because they wanted to stay together while you were in the house. All those sort of things happen, and that's just part of life.
I'm trying to think of a response. I guess I have a different take on eternity, and I sort of explained it to you once before, and you said, yeah, but that's not the definition. You said eternity means to go on forever and ever, and I was sort of like, eternity for me is more than that. But I do believe that what you were saying, that, you know, belief in heaven can be pernicious. See, now I feel intelligent.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it can give people a reason to do horrible things, but focusing on eternity is just that thing which comes with afterlife.
Is God eternal in the dictionary sense that he goes on forever?
Well, God is, was, and always will be.
That sounds a lot like infinity eternal.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. For me, just it's hard to get your brain to try and, because you can't really imagine it, because we live in a linear existence where everything has a beginning and everything has an end. This is our universe. This is our understanding. But for me, where did that come from? So it sort of comes from out of something which is eternal. So that's part of my faith. For me, it's about having an eternal focus, is not having a focus necessarily on the afterlife, but having a focus on sort of like being in harmony with God or something. So focused on life, because life, it's not a game. I don't think it's a game. I don't think it's a test. I don't think it's heaven at the moment. I don't think it's hell either. I don't even really believe in hell. But life isn't irrelevant. And now is the most relevant thing that we have, this right now, this second. And we've constructed ways to measure time. We count it in seconds, minutes, hours, centuries. But it's sort of this weird thing. We just have this now. I can't go back into the past. I can't live in the past. even though some sort of might, I don't know, some claim that I might fashionably still be living in the 90s. And as much as I'm a sci-fi geek, I can't live in the future. I just live in the now. There's a quote from me, another of my favourite authors, C.S. Lewis, who said, "For the present is the point at which time touches eternity." It's part of why I wanted this to be called the Eternity Ward. But yeah, so for the present is the point at which time touches eternity. So I sort of believe that our linear existence is interwoven with eternity. Yeah, so it's being in harmony with God or the universe or whatever you want to call it. And when we're in harmony with that, when we're not just sitting around in the waiting room reading our Reader's Digest or watching the clock, waiting for our time to be called, I guess that's what I live for. That's the eternal focus that I sort of try and strive for. And that's why I have conversations of value like this conversation that I'm having with you. This is what I sort of consider the eternal focus. This is what the stuff that matters. I'm a contradiction. Most of the time I'm just skimming magazines. I'm online. I'm playing.
What sort of magazines, Chris?
New Scientist. There you go.
Oh, sure, sure. What's inside the New Scientist?
What's inside New Scientist? I don't know. Going to Mars.
That's what I meant.
Oh, science is in New Scientist.
No, you missed my joke.
I did. Now you have to enlighten me.
You know the old joke of, you know, a teenage boy holding up a science magazine, but inside it is pornography.
I missed the joke.
Yeah, that's okay. No one gets my jokes, Chris. Well, I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier.
Yeah.
So it seems like you use the word eternity specifically to talk about positive things, whereas the Bible doesn't just talk about positive things being eternal. Like, it talks about heaven, but it also talks about hell. But then you talk about creating heaven on earth, that sort of thing, but you also hope for an afterlife sort of heaven, but that you don't believe in hell at all. Like, I mean, presumably you believe it as being a present reality, as the Bible talks about. Like, I presume you've read Rob Bell about the way he talks about hell as being, you know, evil that is in the world, that is hell.
Yeah.
But you don't believe in an afterlife. How can you justify believing in one as being both meanings and hell as being just the present day and not the afterlife?
Yeah, so we have free will to choose good or evil, our actions, and they all have consequences. We have the free will to do that. So we can bring heaven or hell to earth. Yeah, we can do that. But for me, there being an eternal hell, a God that sends, you know, judges and sends people to hell for eternity, that's not good news. And they talk about, you know, the gospel as good news, and that's not good news. And that's, for me, that's not really even in the gospel. When they're talking about hell, it's not mentioned much at all. When it's mentioned, it's, you know, the, like I think Rob Bell did talk about it, you know, it's more to do with the rubbish dump, to do with, you know, the evil that's in the world. For me, a God that sends, it doesn't fit. I have problems with the Bible.
Hello, confirmation bias.
I've thrown bunches of it out. Well, it doesn't fit with a loving God. So, yeah, we get back to that question of what would a loving God do? I don't think a loving God would send people to hell. Now, maybe we get a free will choice to, because we can choose to be in harmony with God or not. You know, so maybe come post our life, we can choose to not be with God. But for God to judge a person and send them there, it doesn't sit with me. I don't feel that in my bones. It's doesn't work. If God sends people to hell, that's frightening. Eternity in hell, that's a horror story.
And how could you even enjoy being in heaven knowing that there were people being tormented forever? I don't understand how any good person could enjoy being in heaven. Like, as awful as Hitler was, I don't want him to be tortured for all of eternity. I want him to realize how screwed up he was and how screwed up he made the world. And I want him the chance at redemption. That's one of the beautiful things about Christianity, that there's this message of salvation, this idea that no matter how screwed up you are, that you are always within the bounds of redemption.
And so why can't that happen even beyond your life here now? Why is there a point where people think that redemption is not available?
Because the Bible says so.
Does it? Does it?
Well, it says there's a judgment day. It says that God will separate the sheep from the goats.
But then we're getting into this other whole area. Who wrote the Bible? Why are we taking that as literal truth?
Because most Christians do.
Yeah, I know. We're not most Christians, Nick. Well, you're not even a Christian.
We are not. It is one of the frustrating things. I watch a lot of those Richard Dawkins or your Sam Harris's or your Christopher Hitchens debating whoever, religious person. And I don't mean that condescendingly. Like, they're intelligent people, they're debating. But, like, you watch those debates and every time I watch it, I think, this religious person is not like most religious people that I come across. They have thought about all these complex issues and, like, most of them believe in evolution, whereas most Christians I come across just either don't believe it flat out or just say, well, we don't know. Whereas, like, all the stuff you were talking about just then about hell, like, most pew-sitting Christians will just have this belief that there is a hell and that they have to do the right things or they'll end up there. And that is a driving motivation for them to be Christians.
Motivated by fear. That's not a motivation that I can calmly say comes from God. It doesn't fit. Doesn't sit with my spirit. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so you were saying stuff before which made me think of this as well. I'm interested how, like, you seem to just have this innate notion that there is a good God, and whenever anything contradicts that or seems incongruous to the idea of a loving God.
You just want to say that I'm suffering from confirmation bias.
Yeah, well, you just throw your hands up in the air and go, I don't know how it fits, doesn't make sense to me. Instead of actually allowing that to fester within you and go, holy shit.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I have allowed it to fester at times. And I had someone point out to me that if I'm not listening to the Bible as a reference point, then I'm setting myself up for the reference point of truth in the whole universe. I'm the reference point of truth when I'm just going from what fits, what feels right. That scared me. You know, I'm like, I don't want to be arrogant enough to think that I'm the reference point for truth in the universe. That's crazy. I also don't really know how else to do it. I think you try and listen. You can go to the Bible as a source of truth. You can go to science as a source of truth. You can go to friends as a source of truth. You can go to authors like we've been talking about a bit. There's a whole lot of different ways to find truth. And one of those truths is, again, I can't prove this, but I believe that human beings have a soul, you know, a spirit. There's something about us that's, I don't know, metaphysical. And in a way for me, it's like that resonates with truth. You have to embrace doubt and say, I could be wrong. You don't really know, but there are times when I hear things that people tell me, this is what we think is true, and some of it will resonate with me and I'll go, yeah, that makes sense to me. That feels right. It's, you know, resonating is when, you know, the vibrations attune. And so I'll try and take that on. And if it doesn't resonate with me, then I guess I need to find justifications. I mean, when you tell someone that their beliefs are wrong, then people often dig in and they're going to get further and further stuck in their beliefs. And I don't want to be like that, but I'm the same as everyone else, you know, so.
Yeah. There's a, I can't remember who said this quote, but I love it. It's that that I don't want to hold any incorrect belief 1 second longer than I have to. So I want to be constantly searching for what beliefs that I hold that are wrong. And the only way you can do that is by engaging with other people who've lived different lives to you and who see the world from a different perspective and listening without being judgmental and saying, you know, maybe they know something that I don't.
Mm. And it's hard to do. I get really frustrated a lot with Christians. I'll often talk about Christians. It's my own backyard, I guess. You know, this is so but I often get frustrated with Christians who won't go and won't go and watch a particular movie or won't read a certain book by a particular author because they've been told that this is it's heresy and it's dangerous and maybe
it's of the devil.
And maybe I shouldn't have put you under Peter Rollins. But but I feel like if you can't listen to an opposing belief or opposing idea, value, then your own faith, your own belief, your own values are really weak if they can't stand up. And I find that pretty pathetic, really. Don't be weak. You know, if... yeah, that's it's frustrating to me that someone, yeah, won't listen because they fear that it's going to corrupt their own view. And I'm going, well, your views are pretty weak if they can't stand up to hearing someone else. It's pretty harsh.
This is why we get on so well, Chris, because we like taking our clothes off and wrestling.
Yeah, thanks for the imagery.
Well, so you mentioned a soul a couple of minutes ago about your belief that we have a soul, even though you have no evidence for it. You said that. I'm not trying to have a dig at you. One of the things that I've come across in the last few years, I went to a Christian school and was unsurprisingly not taught about evolution. Or if I was, it was only in derogatory terms like, oh, how silly is this idea? But so, you know, now that I'm an adult and don't have to listen to my crap science teacher that I had at my Christian school, listening to how it all works and how much sense it makes and how there really isn't any scientific doubt about evolution. So like the Pope believes in evolution, Cardinal George Pell believes in evolution, John Dixon from the Australian Centre for Christianity believes in evolution.
Hey, Chris, the reference point for all truth in the universe, he believes in evolution.
Chris believes in evolution.
Yeah, that's me. Yep.
Go you. So coming to the understanding that we really did evolve along the same lines as apes and that all of us do have common ancestors and none of us, going all the way back to the first single cell organism, none of us have ever been a different species to our parents or our grandparents or our great-grandparents. This idea of a soul becomes troubling to me because, you know, the Christianity that I was brought up in was that humans are different. Like we are, you know, like you mentioned it before, we are made in God's image in a way that other animals aren't. That becomes troubling when you understand evolution to the point where we really are just animals and we have a brain that has evolved to be more intelligent than other animals, but there was never any point where humans just poof came into existence. It was a gradual process over millions of years. So if you want to believe that humans have a soul, then I don't understand how you could believe that ants don't have a soul. And so every time you walk out to put the clothes out on the washing line, you have to be super careful where you're treading because you're going to be killing lovely God-inspired souls.
I don't believe ants have souls.
So how do you get souls for humans if ants don't?
Yeah, it's troubling. I guess God being in this dimension of eternity and we're in this linear sort of existence. So in a sense, for me, God's outside of time. So at some point, God puts a soul in a human being and it doesn't make us an afterthought. It was just at the right point in evolution, this is like a good time. We'll put the soul in here. We'll do it now. What about that?
So, like, you know? Did he put a soul in, like, one individual person? Or
maybe a bunch of people in different nations around the world at the same time? It was soul day. I don't know.
And so there were parents who didn't get a soul, but their kids did.
Good point.
Sucks to be that parent. If only you'd come a decade later.
Well, I mean, they wouldn't really know, would they? The parents, their awareness is not at that sort of soul state that their child is, so what would it matter to them?
So you're saying that, like, they had a kid and their kid was so, like, their kids' awareness was just on another plane completely to what their parents were. These kids were raised by these bumbling idiots.
Maybe God put the soul into the child after the parents had passed away then? How's that for a theory?
Yeah, okay. There's problems there. I mean, you're talking about millions of years ago when humans' life expectancy was probably 30 years. And so a good percentage of those luckily born at the right time humans who would get souls, many of them would have died before they reached the age of soul inhibiting. No, that's not the right word.
That'd be interesting though, wouldn't it? If you're a teenager and you're just thinking, I don't know.
Sex?
Sex, berries.
New Scientist magazines.
Hunt, whatever. And then suddenly you've got a soul. Suddenly you're like, whoa, what is this thing that I'm feeling? What is this? Maybe the soul evolved along with evolution, you know, maybe, but that's still problematic as well. Yeah, it's problematic. I don't have answers for you. I wasn't there.
What?
I'm old, but I wasn't there.
This is why I rang you, Chris. I thought you were around.
But a human is an interesting thing. What is a human? And I find it like when you get a biologist, you ask a biologist, what is a human? They'll tell you that, you know, it's these cells and hormones and all of these different elements, you know, all put together and all working together and everything, you know, the blood's pumping and it's breathing in the oxygen. So they, you know, they tell you that's what a human is. And then you ask like your Peter Rollins philosopher type guy, what is a human? And, you know, he might say something about ego states, you know, and about, you know, the psychology of what makes a human, you know. Then you ask a priest, what is a human? And a priest will say, well, a human, you know, is this soul that's connected to God, you know. And so I think, you know, different people will often come at what is a human being from, I guess, the prism of their own field of expertise or something, you know. So they've got this sort of narrow view of what a human is, but I don't think any of them are wrong. I just think that they're all right. So where did the soul come from? I don't know. Can I prove that it exists? No. But we're very clever animals if we're having these sorts of conversations, these sorts of philosophical, theological conversations about what matters and about life, the universe and everything. If there's not something that's, you know, different about us, maybe animals have souls. I certainly look into my dog's eyes and I see eternity there, but I see eternity in sunsets. I see eternity in the mountains and in the eyes of human beings. They say the eyes are the windows to the soul. I hate cliches. But we still haven't really spoken about where is God. Wasn't that the initial question?
Yeah, where is he?
Where's God?
I thought you had him on the line. I thought he was going to be the mystery caller.
Well, God was in eternity. I think we established that sort of in that we're the present is the moment that touches eternity. But why does, yeah, we have been exploring the question somewhat, haven't we?
Yes, we've definitely been exploring it.
All right. Any other questions we need to explore?
There's a question I've got for you.
All right. We'll head towards wrapping it up, hey?
That sounds like fun. So you and I both share a lot of these doubts. Like a lot of the questions that I've raised, you sort of come to the point of going, meh, who knows? And I find that really fascinating that you and I both have, in a lot of ways, the same sort of doubts as each other. But there's something that keeps you coming back to belief in God, belief in an afterlife. And I'm interested what that is, how you keep coming back in the face of these doubts and these questions that don't seem to have nice, neat answers.
Because I'm crazy. I don't know. Believing in God is a bit crazy, but a lot of us are crazy. There's a lot of us. Just all the people in your life are Christians, aren't they? They're all crazy.
Yeah, it's like, 90% of the human population. And I mean, if you go back in history, I'm sure it'd be a higher percentage than that.
Yeah, I'm one of the crazy ones. But how do I? So yes, I have these doubts. But I think even when I was about 14 or 15, and I was going to, my father was talking at churches. He was speaking at churches a lot for his mission work, and I got really frustrated because we'd go to all of these different churches, and I had this real social justice streak, and I didn't really see them talking about what I thought mattered in the world. All they ever wanted to really talk about was this heaven and hell stuff a lot. Or to talk about Jesus all the time. Like, oh, just shut up about Jesus, please. You know,
I love you, Jesus.
I'm like, there's people starving in Africa, you know, like, come on, let's, you know. And so I was frustrated, but there was one church I went to where they had this, and a lot of people have probably seen this sort of thing where they put on this presentation where they had these people walk down this aisle and they had a message scrawled on card hanging on their chest. And it, you know, it said, you know, I'm a Christian. And so they walked up the front and the person sent them to heaven, you know. And the next person comes up, you know, and they're like, you know, I'm an atheist. Oh, you go to hell, you know. And it's like, and then, you know, the next person comes up and says, I'm someone from the Amazon jungle and I've never heard of the gospel before. And the pastor or priest or whatever it was said, you go to hell. And I was like, what? I was like, that doesn't make sense. That's ridiculous. And I was really angry. And the next time we went to go to a church, and it's been my whole sort of life, was Christians and going to churches and stuff like that. And I sat in the back of the car and I told my dad I wasn't going in. So then I explained to him why, and I explained through tears because I was letting my dad down. And it was really, really hard thing for me to do, to say that. His response was that he was proud of me. Proud of me for standing up for what I believed in. And so he went into the church and did his thing. I stayed in the car and I didn't go back to church for about 15 years because I thought that Christians very much were hypocrites. They, you know, sort of have this high ideal that they wanted to live life by, and then they didn't really do that a lot. But, yeah, 15 years later I sort of came to peace with the fact that it's okay to have a high ideal and not be able to live up to it. You know, we're just human, so I'm a hypocrite too. You know, if you're not trying to live to some sort of high ideal, then I don't know, it's a bit lame. So I started this journey back to, but there were all of these obstacles. So I read a lot, read the Bible, read books by other authors, explaining bits about the Bible that I had trouble with and was able to make peace with some of it, but still not with a lot of it.
Not with Leviticus.
No, not with Leviticus at all. I actually almost tore that out of my Bible, that whole book. I was just like going, I might as well just tear it out.
You know, the thing that infuriates me is you talk to a Christian about Leviticus and they don't even know what you're talking about.
The thing that differentiates a Christian, you know, from Judaism is we've got the New Testament.
Okay, well, read Romans chapter 18, which talks about homosexuals should be put to death.
Okay.
Anyway, I interrupted you, sorry.
No, but that's all right. I mean, one of the things that I really came to a lot in the end was that the Bible wasn't the word of God in one sense, in the sense that God didn't dictate it and human beings sat down and wrote it, you know, word for word. The Bible is a collection of stories written by human beings in their best attempt to explain, understand, wrestle with, you know, this whole concept that we're wrestling with now. You know, it's human beings who had all sorts of experiences that they thought could be attributed to God and stuff. So for me, the Bible was written by human beings, and that doesn't make it not valuable. It doesn't mean that it wasn't inspired by God. It was inspired by God in the sense that they felt inspired to write it. You know, they were inspired by something that they thought was bigger than themselves. But for me, that doesn't mean that I can take it all literally as God's word. The only words I can take as literally as God's words is, well, I do believe in Jesus. So I've got to try and take his words as the words of God, if I'm going to believe that Jesus was the Son of God, I still reserve doubts, but I still choose to believe because I feel it in my bones. And I've had, would like to not believe, but I just sort of feel like I feel like I do. And to deny that would be denying who I am, denying my spirit, my soul, my nature. There are times when I fleeted very much with denying it. Believing in a God is weird. Like some people say, oh, you believe in the sky fairy or the, what do they call it? The spaghetti.
Flying spaghetti monster, is it?
Yeah, the flying spaghetti monster, something like that. I'm like, no one believes in a sky fairy or a flying spaghetti monster. That's ridiculous, even though some people claim that they do. But believing in a God that you can't prove, it's essentially saying that, you know, you believe in magic. Because to believe that something created the universe and or created humanity, you know, is that something is powerful, something is metaphysical or spiritual, it's mysterious. There's that word again. It's but there's something that's not tangible about humanity that I'm drawn to. And I think that that's something sort of connects us to the eternal. And if I can believe in a soul or a spirit, then believing in God isn't that much of a jump. So from that starting point, I guess I choose to believe and I choose to try and be in harmony with that thing. And I think that it's bloody difficult. It's just really hard. So you
and I, Chris, we share a fascination with the universe, and we love looking at the stars at night time and learning more about how all this came into being in a universal type way. And the more, I don't know if you feel the same way, but the more I learn about that sort of science sort of area, the more I feel that it just feels magical because it's so far beyond what I can comprehend that you and I are literally made up of stardust. And I tell this to kids at school all the time and they're like, you're joking, you're a lunatic. And so, yeah, there really is magic in the universe, and I find that awe-inspiring, and I love that. And I love the way your dad responded to your doubt when you had that experience in your church, and that you had this pissed offness and all these questions, and your dad said, I'm proud of you. And that's sort of the thing I like about these conversations, that we're able to have these chats, and at the end of it, there's no judgment. There's no, you're an idiot.
That statement was foundational in my whole being. Just that one statement in that one moment in time. I've never forgotten it because it's meant a lot to me about who I am and who I want to be and how I want to treat others.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, that's like I mentioned Job, like that's sort of how I anticipate if there is a loving God, like I anticipate that when that judgment day comes, that God will slap me around a little bit and say, you idiot, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? But at the same time, he'll go, you know, I'm proud of you for being genuine, for not just trying to sweep your doubts under the carpet. If God truly is loving, then the only way I see that working out is if he not only tolerant and accepting, but actually supportive of these sort of conversations, and of all of us expressing whatever questions and doubts and craziness we have.
Yeah. Yeah. I would add on to that, that if life is, you know, a gift from God, then now is where it is lived, and now matters, and how we treat each other, it matters, and how we treat the earth, it matters. And if you're not making now and all of the nows, you know, to come better, you know, like if we go back, if you think killing people is okay because they'll be at rest in heaven finally, well, that's I think that's disrespecting the now. It's it's against the better parts of our nature, you know, and that's what I want to see come to life in our conversations, or I see it in literature, and I see it in sport and music and art and activism, and I see it in love and in making love. I guess I see things like mindfulness and meditation and stuff like that a lot on the rise now. In a sense, I'm not sort of surprised, because I think that we get very conditioned now to gravitate to sort of constant distractions and stuff like that. And I think, you know, people sometimes feel like they, you know, they're missing something, and I think they're missing being sort of rooted in the now. Mm. So that's what I guess I want some of this podcast to address. And we'll be addressing all sorts of issues and topics and stuff to come, won't we?
Absolutely. This is just the beginning.
So thanks for joining us.
Outstanding.
God here again. Are you shaking your head incredulously or nodding in approval? Well, if you got something out of this episode, you could really help those poor idiots by contributing to or supporting the Eternity Ward. You can leave reviews on iTunes or wherever you listen to it. You can share it on social media or discuss it in your blog, podcast, or fellowship group. Subscribe, like, nod your head, raise your fist, send a hallelujah. I don't know, but don't send a prayer, because I'm kind of busy right now. Join the discussion in the comments section, ask questions, and do come back and join us again here on the Eternity Ward. We'll be right back.